Hearing to order of the Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee on European Affairs, and apologize for being a little late this afternoon. As you may have heard, there's a lot going on. We have about 28 votes that are starting at 2:30, so I think we will probably pass the gavel back and forth so that we can try and continue the hearing while the votes are going on. And in the interest of expediting my remarks to get to each of you, I'm going to submit my opening statement for the record and just start by welcoming three important nominees to advance America's foreign policy: Ambassador Jane Hartley, who's been nominated to the Court of St. James in the United Kingdom, Constance Milstein, nominated to the Republic of Malta, and Alan Leventhal, nominated to the Kingdom of Denmark. Welcome to each of you. This hearing will also review the nomination of Dr. Bruce Turner to serve as U.S. representative to the Conference on Disarmament. So again, we're delighted to be able to hear from each of you today and to have a chance to ask you some questions about what we hope will be soon to be confirmed posts. Now, let me again, submit my remarks for the record, along with a statement from Senator Coons, who is not going to be able to be here, but also wanted a statement entered into the record, and turn it over to the ranking member, Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll follow your fine example and also ask my opening statement be entered the record. I also want to welcome the nominees and thank them for their past service, but also for their willingness to serve in these capacities as well. So I'm looking forward to hearing from your testimony, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Let me also recognize the ranking member of the full committee, Senator Risch. We're glad that you are here as well. And I know we're waiting for Senator Schumer, who we think is going to come to do introductions of Ambassador Hartley and Ms. Milstein. But in the meantime, I'm going to ask Senator Markey if he would like to introduce Mr. Leventhal.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and it's my honor to be here today to introduce Alan Leventhal, nominated to be the United States Ambassador to the Kingdom of Denmark. Joining Alan today are his wife, Sherry, and his son, Alexander, and it's a proud day for the Leventhal family, which has had a long, rich history in the city of Boston, transforming it. He is a son of the Commonwealth in his highly successful business, academic, and nonprofit endeavors. He has left his mark on Boston and beyond. First, in the literal sense, his company has made downtown Boston's financial districts bustling as a destination, and it was also behind the revitalization of the Boston Harbor through the construction of Rose Wharf and really opening up Boston Harbor to the city of Boston for the first time in 50 years. And more importantly, Alan has left his mark in improving the lives of those in his community. In the fight against cancer, he funded the Sharpest Minds as chair of the Damon Runyon Cancer Research Service. Their track record was impressive. 12 of the individuals they funded ended up winning the Nobel Prize. He has also left his mark in education, which he considers his true passion. He served on the governing board at MIT, which dedicates $2 billion every year in research funding to tackle the top challenges our country faces. Alan jokes that he may be the only one in his family that does not have a degree from Boston University, but through his transformational work as chair of the Board of Trustees at BU, he created greater opportunities for tens of thousands of proud BU graduates during his tenure. He will assume his post in Copenhagen at a time of great turmoil in the European continent. Denmark plays an outsized role in supporting UN peacekeeping operations and the counter-ISIS campaign. Unsurprisingly, Denmark has again risen to the challenge in Europe's response to Russia's illegal invasion of Ukraine, including by weaning itself off of Russian fossil fuels. As Ambassador, Alan will play a key role in building upon that unified response to Russian aggression. It is a country of just 6 million people, but it has few peers. when it comes to the global fight against climate change. Alan knows because his buildings are the best buildings in terms of energy efficiency that can be constructed. He in Boston brought together business and civic leaders through the Boston Green Ribbon Commission to show that clean energy is good for our economies and for our planet. We are very proud of him in Massachusetts, but it's his lifetime of work in combating the scourge of cancer, the climate crisis, and training the next generation of American leaders that makes Massachusetts not just the Bay State, but the brain state, and we're proud to have him as someone who represents our state. The diversity of his experience also makes him a fantastic choice to be our top diplomat to the Kingdom of Denmark at a moment of great consequence for our country and the planet. I urge his swift confirmation by the Foreign Relations Committee and by the United States Senate. I thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Senator Markey. I understand that Senator Schumer is only a few minutes away, so with your indulgence, I would like to introduce Dr. Bruce Turner, and then we will start testimony from Dr. Turner headed towards Ambassador Hartley, and hope that before we get too far along, Senator Schumer will be here. And Senator Markey, I know that you may have to leave, and feel free to do that whenever you're ready.
Thank you,
Dr. Bruce Turner has been nominated to be U.S. Representative to the Conference on Disarmament. Dr. Turner has a distinguished record of service with the Department of State that will enhance U.S. presence at the Conference on Disarmament, which is a crucial body supporting arms control and disarmament. And as we know, these issues are even more pressing right now, given the new threats to democratic security around the world, including from Russia, China, and North Korea. All of these appointments today come in a moment, an important moment for global security as the U.S. faces new threats from our adversaries, including Russia. So while we continue to await Senator Schumer, I will ask Dr. Turner if you would like to begin your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ranking Member Johnson, and distinguished members of the committee. It is the honor of a lifetime to appear before you as the President's nominee to be the U.S. Permanent Representative to the Conference on Disarmament, or CD, in Geneva. I am also grateful to Secretary Blinken and Undersecretary Jenkins for their support of this new opportunity for me to serve the American people. My parents understood what it meant to serve our country during World War II. Likewise, my wife Veronique has been at my side every step of our State Department journey, and our two children grew up in the Foreign Service family. Diplomacy has been my life's work, and I cannot think of anything I would rather have done. In seeking confirmation for this position, I am acutely aware of the CD's illustrious history in producing the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, the Biological Weapons Convention, the Chemical Weapons Convention, and the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. I am also aware that we have failed to gain the support of critical countries for negotiations on a fissile material cutoff treaty, the next logical step. Moreover, some of the arms control treaties negotiated in the CD are effectively under assault. Most recently, Russia, a states party that has used chemical weapons and that has an offensive program, is making unfounded accusations that Ukraine plans to use chemical weapons in Russia's unprovoked war against Ukraine. Russia's nuclear rhetoric and threats in connection with its invasion of Ukraine are also recklessly escalatory and hard to reconcile with President Putin's endorsement of the statement in January by the leaders of the P5, the five nuclear weapon states that are permanent members of the UN Security Council, that a nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought. Growing strategic competition, encompassing Russia's history of arms control violations and China's repeated unwillingness to engage meaningfully in arms control discussions as it builds up its own nuclear forces, has caused some to question the value of such agreements. It is true that achieving consensus on such matters has become increasingly elusive and difficult. Russia's most recent actions and the PRC's tacit, and in some cases overt, support for them have rendered the challenge even more daunting. These developments only underscore the continuing need for American engagement and leadership. Given the stakes, we can only redouble our efforts as we continue to protect our security and that of our allies and partners. Russia is still complying with the New START Treaty. Through the P5, the PRC acknowledged the need for engagement with the United States on risk reduction and a dialogue to strengthen stability. I believe the coming year does offer further opportunities to exert U.S. leadership. If confirmed, I would hope to contribute to a positive outcome of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty Review Conference later this year. Nonproliferation remains a core national security interest. It is the key to peaceful uses of nuclear energy and the basis for pursuing the eventual goal of a world without nuclear weapons, understanding that progress must take into account today's challenging security conditions and that it can only proceed through progressive steps subject to effective verification. If confirmed, I will also seek to contribute to our successful efforts in the UN General Assembly's First Committee to reinforce and strengthen international arms control and nonproliferation cooperation, including increased international support for development of norms of behavior in space. The United States is already leading the way through Vice President Harris's announcement of a commitment not to conduct destructive direct ascent anti-satellite missile tests. I would also seek to build upon the Geneva diplomatic platform offered by the standing delegation to the CD, which has supported a variety of arms control and international security efforts, to include those of Deputy Secretary Sherman and Undersecretary Jenkins in the U.S.-Russia Strategic Stability Dialogue. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee has a distinguished and successful history of supporting arms control efforts on a bipartisan basis. If confirmed, I commit to be available to consult closely with this committee and other members of Congress, as well as their staffs. In working to achieve our long-term nuclear disarmament and other arms control objectives, I believe the CD remains an essential multilateral institution. If confirmed, I will do all that I can to make the CD an active contributor to international peace and security while always protecting the security interests of the United States and its allies and partners. Thank you again so much for the opportunity to come before you today. I look forward to any questions you may have. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Dr. Turner. Senator Schumer, we've been waiting for you. We're delighted you made it.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and to all the members of the committee. Thank you for the honor of introducing two exceptional nominees, both whip smart, both accomplished, both experienced women who hail from New York. Jane Hartley to be ambassador to the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and Connie Milstein, our next ambassador to Malta. It's an honor to introduce both of you. Now, Jane is here today with her husband, Ralph, who I hear is having his retirement party today. So congratulations, Ralph, on all of your hard work. Jane's children, Kate and Jamie, who actually went to school with my daughter, Allison, couldn't be here today, but I'm sure they're cheering their mother on from home. Now, I'm really proud to have urged President Biden to nominate Jane Hartley as our ambassador to the UK. She would be the only the second woman to ever serve as UK ambassador and the first in nearly half a century. Only the second woman ever to serve as UK ambassador and the first in nearly half a century. It's amazing. And I can't think of a more qualified person to do it than my friend Jane Hartley. This isn't the first ambassadorship that Jane would hold. In 2014, she was appointed U.S. ambassador to France under President Obama, where her time coincided with the horrible Paris terrorist attacks of 2015. It was an extremely difficult period for both of our countries, and Jane represented the U.S. with great distinction. In the aftermath of these attacks, she dedicated her time as ambassador to strengthening U.S.-French counterterrorism cooperation, and was awarded the Legion of Honor from the President of France in the recognition of her efforts. Jane has served our country in other ways for decades, in the Carter administration as CEO of the G7 Group, and most recently as CEO of the Observatory Group, a major global firm based in New York. The bottom line is this: she would bring to this ambassadorship a depth of experience, a love of democracy, and democratic institutions, and a deep loyalty to the values both the United States and the UK hold dear. I can't think of a better person. I've known Jane for decades to be ambassador to our longtime ally, the United Kingdom. Now, it's also my honor to introduce another proud New Yorker, Connie Milstein, whom President Biden has nominated to be the next U.S. ambassador to Malta. Connie's joined here by her husband, Saeed. And even though they are not in attendance, I want to acknowledge Connie's daughters, Abby and Johanna, as well as her wonderful granddaughter, Sarah. I know they're all proud today. Now, Connie comes from a longtime New York family. Her grandfather was the founder of a successful business in New York prior to World War II, and her father, a World War II vet, started his first company in Newbury, New York. Their roots in the Empire State run very deep. Connie comes before this committee as a deeply experienced attorney, businesswoman, and advocate for international affairs. She'll make an exceptional U.S. ambassador because her career has been completely focused on the skills and values necessary to any diplomatic post. Among her experiences, she has dedicated her career to looking out for veterans, creating successful profits like the Dog Tag Bakery to help veterans with disabilities, served on the Global Progress Initiative at the Center for American Progress, meeting with world leaders to discuss today's pressing geopolitical problems, and also served on the board of trustees of one of the great universities of New York in America, NYU, and she expanded the university's global reach. She also served on Nobel Peace Laureate Kailash Satyarthi's foundation and worked with him to end childhood slavery and trafficking. In short, Connie is both a proud New Yorker, but also a true citizen of the world. She brings a wide range of depth and experience to the post, and I know she'll carry out her responsibilities with distinction, and I'm proud to introduce her today. Finally, I want to acknowledge two other individuals who are coming before the committee. The first is Alan Leventhal, who I've known for a very long time. I know Senator Markey was here. He's been nominated to serve as U.S. Ambassador to the Kingdom of Denmark, and he's one of Boston's top business people. And second, I also want to recognize Bruce Turner, who you just heard from, a longtime member of the Foreign Service, who has not been nominated as representative to the Conference on Disarmament. They will both represent the U.S. with distinction. So I thank the members of the committee, congratulate all of today's outstanding public servants for their nominations, and yield back the rest of my time.
Thank you very much, Senator Schumer, and we know you have to get to the floor, so feel free to leave whenever you're ready. And I'm going to continue down the dais, if that's all right, with our nominees, and ask Mr. Leventhal if he would like to offer his testimony after he says hello to Senator Schumer. Although, Senator Schumer, you can't claim Mr. Leventhal. I know he's from Boston. Yes. So
can't claim him. Right.
Probably, he's closer to me.
He's probably even a Red Sox fan.
So go ahead, Mr. Leventhal. And I should have said this before you offered your testimony, Dr. Turner. Feel free to introduce any family members or friends that you have here with you today.
Chairwoman Shaheen, Ranking Member Johnson, and distinguished members of the committee, it is a privilege to appear before you. I am honored to be the nominee for U.S. Ambassador to the Kingdom of Denmark, and I thank President Biden and Secretary Blinken for their confidence in me. I would like to acknowledge my wife, Sherry, who has been such a source of strength and has supported me in all my endeavors. And I'd also like to acknowledge my son, Alex, who is here representing his sisters and brothers. I would like to remember my parents, who instilled in me the importance of service to community and country. This has led me to leadership roles in organizations that have had meaningful impact on the world. As Senator Markey mentioned in his introduction, I served for 10 years as chair of Damon Runyon Cancer Research Foundation, which is known as the venture capital of cancer research. 13 of the individuals we funded later won the Nobel Prize. I am a member of the governing board of MIT, one of the top-rated research institutions in the world. Its mission is to help solve the great global challenges, including climate, health, cancer, water. In my business, I've led transformational developments to improve the urban environment. My companies have created thousands of affordable housing units for working families. In each of these endeavors, I have worked with smart people who bring diverse views, backgrounds, and experiences. I approach each challenge by listening and treating my colleagues with dignity and respect. If confirmed, I hope to use these skills to successfully advance U.S. interests and values in the Kingdom of Denmark. If confirmed, my first priority would be to ensure the safety and security of U.S. citizens in the Kingdom of Denmark. My second priority will be to advance our shared security interests, especially in light of Russia's brutal and unprovoked war against Ukraine. As the only country that is a member of NATO, the EU, and the Arctic Council, Denmark partners with the United States on many issues. Denmark currently leads the NATO mission in Iraq and is a close global partner on security issues. If confirmed, I will work to ensure Denmark's commitment to stability and security, as well as meeting its NATO defense spending commitments. My third priority is to strengthen our economic relationships, promoting bilateral exports and recovery from COVID-19, as well as expanding Danish investment in the United States in order to create good-paying jobs for working families. Denmark has some of the world's leading companies working on global issues like climate change. My own company, Beacon Capital Partners, has been a leader in sustainability, receiving EPA's Energy Star Partner of the Year Award for 11 consecutive years. If confirmed, I would draw on my experiences to promote mutual exchanges and investment between the United States and the Kingdom of Denmark, including the Faroe Islands and Greenland. My final priority, if confirmed, will be to promote and strengthen the ties of our best academic and research institutions with their counterparts in the kingdom. Denmark's renowned research institutions recently marked the 100th anniversary of both the founding of the Niels Bohr Institute and the awarding of the Nobel Prize in Physics to Niels Bohr. To ensure our relations are as strong in the future as they are today, I would engage with the people of Denmark, the Faroe Islands, and Greenland to expand people-to-people ties through exchange programs and robust public diplomacy efforts. If confirmed, I look forward to supporting the safety and morale of Mission Kingdom of Denmark, both at the embassy in Copenhagen and our consulate in Nuuk. I also look forward to working with Congress to further U.S. priorities in the Kingdom of Denmark, one of our closest European allies. I would like to highlight that today, at this very moment, the people of Denmark are lighting candles in their windows at home, for today marks Denmark's liberation from Nazi occupation on May 4, 1945. It underscores that Danes have experienced brutal, unprovoked aggression. It underscores they have experienced occupation, and it speaks to how much they value their freedom. It is fitting that President Zelensky chose today to address Denmark. It would be the greatest honor to represent my country to the Kingdom of Denmark. Thank you for your time and consideration. I look forward to your questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Leventhal. I will now ask Ms. Milstein if she would like to give her testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Ranking Member, distinguished senators of this esteemed committee, I am humbled and honored to appear before you today. I am deeply grateful to the President, Dr. Biden, and Secretary Blinken for the confidence they have placed in me to serve as the United States Ambassador to the Republic of Malta. I would like to acknowledge my husband, Saeed Aboukoud, my children, Abby and Joanna, their husbands, Rick and Bjorn, and my granddaughter, Sarah, who have all shown me unwavering love, support, and patience in my endeavor to follow my lifelong dream to serve our country and to continue my passionate advocacy for fairness, justice, and democracy. I would also like to remember my parents, Seymour and Vivian, who taught me the values of respect, responsibility, and giving. Their service to others was an inspiration to me to lead a life of purpose. My father was a proud veteran of World War II who returned to the United States in 1945 on a hospital plane. Everyone on that plane signed a dollar bill, which my dad carried in his wallet until he died. I too am proud to have had opportunities for service. For decades, I have worked on programs and initiatives dedicated to military service members, disabled veterans, their families, and caregivers. I have always maintained a strong interest in foreign affairs, and I have been active in public policy and global education. My varied experiences as an attorney and businesswoman will empower me to steward our important relationship with the Republic of Malta. Three priorities will guide my work. First, promoting peace and security. If confirmed, my top priority will be to ensure the safety and welfare of U.S. citizens living in or traveling in Malta. Furthermore, I will prioritize the promotion of peace, security, and regional stability. Malta may be the smallest country in the European Union, but it has great strategic importance based on its location adjacent to the Mediterranean Sea's principal shipping routes and at the crossroads of Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East. I believe in growing the bilateral partnership between our two nations as we come together to face regional security challenges, transnational crime, and illicit financing. Promoting peace and security in the region also means encouraging inclusiveness, the protection of human rights, the rule of law, and fundamental freedoms. Second, promoting prosperity, trade, and people-to-people ties. If confirmed, I will increase U.S. and Maltese economic ties. Malta aspires to lead small island nations in sustainable development. Therefore, I will capitalize on our shared goals of promoting prosperity, trade, and people-to-people ties through U.S. innovation and commercial interests in Malta. Third, tackling corruption and impunity. The assassination of Daphne Caruana Galizia, an important Maltese investigative journalist, in October of 2017, showed the danger of corruption in Maltese politics and society. If confirmed, I will champion rule of law efforts and an open and free press. Rule of law reforms regarding anti-money laundering and countering the financing of terrorism are also critical to Malta's efforts to fully implement the Financial Action Task Force Action Plan to remove Malta as a jurisdiction for increased monitoring. In order to fully implement these reforms, Malta will need a stronger financial regulatory environment, which will serve to strengthen and benefit Malta's economic institutions and reputation for the future. If confirmed, I would work with Malta to make these reforms sustainable for the long term. It would be an honor to be a member of the outstanding Embassy Valletta team. And if confirmed, I am committed to working with the members of this committee. Thank you for this opportunity to appear before you. I am happy to answer your questions.
Thanks very much, Ms. Milstein. Ambassador Hartley.
Madam Chair, Ranking Member, and distinguished members of the committee, it is a privilege to appear before you. I am honored to be the nominee for the U.S. Ambassador to the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and I thank President Biden for his confidence in me. The sense of history with our closest ally is certainly not lost on me. I follow in the footsteps of many great Americans, including John Adams, John Quincy Adams, and Martin Van Buren. I'm also thrilled, as Senator Schumer just said, to be the second woman in history to be nominated to this role. And I salute Anne Armstrong for leading the way. First, though, I would like to thank my family. My children, who are the light of my life, Chuck mentioned earlier, Kate and Jamie. Whatever I do in life, my most important title will always be mom. And of course, my husband, who is with me today, and partner, of 39 years, without whose support none of this would be possible. My parents taught me that we were lucky to live in the greatest country on earth, and that the highest honor was to serve our nation. From my early life, I have believed this strongly, and public service has been very important to me. My time as ambassador to France coincided with the terrible surge in terrorism that shook our two nations. The extraordinary staff at Embassy Paris performed their duties with grace and strength in the face of terror and loss. It emphasized to me that dedicated American and local staff of our overseas missions and everywhere in our government advance our interests and protect our security every single day. It was another reminder how critical public service is to our nation. The UK and the United States are two great countries bound by history, friendship, and especially now, a shared commitment to the universal values of freedom and liberty. During the ongoing crisis in Ukraine, we have seen the strength of the UK response and the many ways also in which the British public has volunteered in support of Ukrainians. If confirmed, it will be my mission to strengthen America's special relationship with the UK, and I hope to focus on four overarching goals. First, protect Americans and deepen bilateral security cooperation. My top priority will be the safety and security of Americans. As the recent events in Europe have made very clear, crystal clear, frankly, we have no more capable partner in defending against threats to international security than the UK. If confirmed, I will build on these decades of close bilateral security cooperation. I will also work tirelessly to uphold the Belfast Good Friday Agreement, which has been the bedrock of peace and stability and prosperity in Northern Ireland for 25 years. Second, I will broaden economic ties and expand technology and innovation and collaboration. If confirmed, I will focus on reinvigorating bilateral trade, broadening job opportunities for American workers, and addressing the climate crisis. Increasing collaboration supports prosperity for both the United States and the United Kingdom. Third, I will promote and defend our shared values of democracy and freedom. If confirmed, I will seek to strengthen bilateral cooperation to rebuild public faith in democracy, combat authoritarianism wherever it may be, and ensure that our liberty is never, ever taken for granted. Fourth, I will capitalize on the strong ties between our people to guarantee the strength of our enduring alliance. To deepen connections between our people, I will encourage exchanges between our two peoples and ensure citizens from across the United Kingdom, particularly young people, are exposed to the full diversity of our country. None of this is possible without the dedicated and extraordinary talented teams and their family at Embassy London and at our consulates in Hamilton, Edinburgh, and Belfast. I intend to build on their successes, promote American interest, and advance our shared goals together with our closest ally, the United Kingdom. It is my honor to be considered to represent the United States as ambassador to the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. I look forward to partnering with Congress to further U.S. priorities in the U.K. And now I would be happy to answer any questions.
Well, thank you very much, Ambassador Hartley, and thank you to each of you for your testimony and for your willingness to serve the country at this critical time. We have lost Senator Johnson to another committee, but Senator Bourassa will be coming back shortly to on the side of the ranking member, and we will have five-minute questioning rounds. I will begin, and we will alternate between Republican and Democrat on the committee. I'd like to ask each of the ambassadorial nominees about an issue that I have been following closely and am very concerned about. I'm sure you've all seen the reports of directed energy attacks that have affected our government employees around the world. And I want to be clear that each of you are sufficiently prepared to respond accordingly should anything happen in the embassy that you would be representing. I understand that the State Department includes a briefing on this as part of the ambassadorial seminar that you're required to attend, but can I ask each of you, if confirmed, will you commit to attending that seminar on AHIs and seek a classified briefing with the State Department? Ambassador Hartley?
Yes, I will. And I already did attend that seminar and will be seeking a classified briefing. And London's very important because there's a huge medical facility at the embassy. So I want to make sure we are totally informed of everything that has happened. And I promise you I will have the briefings, and I take this issue very seriously.
Thank you very much. Ms. Milstein?
Yes, Senator. I also have taken the course and have learned about the AHI situation. I know at the embassy in Valletta, there have been no cases, at least not so far, but I take this matter very seriously.
Thank you. And Mr. Leventhal.
Senator Shaheen, I understand the seriousness of the issue. I am committed to taking the course, and if I'm confirmed, to work diligently, and if I become aware of an issue, to notice people in the appropriate channels and deal medically with the issue to the best extent possible.
Thank you very much. And Dr. Turner, I assume as a career member of the Foreign Service, you're very aware of this issue.
Indeed, I am. I'm very aware of it. And it occurred in a couple of the posts that I was dealing with very closely while I was still in the State Department, so, and including the city to which I may be assigned. So very aware of this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Ambassador Hartley, I'd like to begin my questions with you, general questions. And you pointed out some of the notable Americans who have preceded you as ambassador to the United Kingdom. I would just point out that there is a very close tie with the state of New Hampshire because former New Hampshire Governor John Wynott served as ambassador to the United Kingdom during most of World War II and is very decorated. Somebody, most Americans don't know a lot about Governor Wynott, but he was a Republican who was nominated by President Roosevelt and served very honorably mm-hmm. as ambassador. So we know you will follow in his footsteps. You talked a little bit about the challenges of the war in Ukraine and what a great ally the United Kingdom has been, of course, not just in this war, but throughout so much of American history. One of the challenges that I have heard from some representatives of Great Britain are the overseas territories that have in the past been havens for corruption and for Russian money. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what priorities we might initiate and how we can engage Great Britain to look at those overseas territories and see how we can cooperate more closely on those as we're looking at how do we hold oligarchs and those responsible for the war in Ukraine accountable?
Mm-hmm. Senator Sheen, I should tell you, Governor Wynott was in my testimony. He is a role model for me, and unfortunately, the State Department thought it was too long, so he was eliminated. But
they should never eliminate
I should
Governor Wynott when I'm chairing the hearing.
I know, I should tell them that. Listen, I think your question is very important. I've been very impressed with what the UK has been doing since the Ukraine situation, invasion, war. I think they've been leaning forward tremendously in terms of sanctions on individuals and on institutions. I think at this point they've sanctioned approximately 1,500. They've also, there's a piece of legislation that I think has just made its way through Parliament, kind of talking about one of the things you're mentioning, which is it's called dirty money. That's not the official title, but they're looking to get at investment, especially in shell companies in the United Kingdom, and for the first time, really, to try to both sanction and open up the books. So I think both in terms of territories and in terms of what's happening in London right now, I think this is something that's a huge priority for the government, and I salute them for how aggressively they're pursuing this.
Thank you. My time is up. Senator Kaine.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and how delightful to see all of you here. I'm very, very, very happy to be at this hearing with you, and I congratulate you on your nominations. Ambassador Hartley, let me begin with you. On May 5, voters go to the polls in Northern Ireland to elect the Assembly. Sinn Féin is the former political wing of the Irish Republican Army, and they're projected to become the biggest political bloc in the Assembly, which would be the first time a party devoted to unification of Ireland would be the dominant political party in that fractious, often fractious region. Uniting Ireland is not on the ballot, but the potential historic shift comes 24 years after the Good Friday Accord ended three decades of sectarian bloodshed. Even though Brexit has exacerbated some of the political and economic challenges within Northern Ireland, the UK and Ireland remain very, very committed to the continued functioning and implementation of the Good Friday Accord. Should you be confirmed, what might you do to make sure that this accord, which the U.S. also invested such significant diplomacy to achieve, would continue to move forward in a harmonious way?
Senator, I totally agree with you. I think the most important thing is to make sure the Good Friday Belfast Agreement stands. It has created peace and prosperity and stability in Northern Ireland for approximately 25 years. I think the Congress and President Biden has made that clear. And if confirmed as ambassador, I would continue to not only make it clear, but make sure both the UK and Northern Ireland knew, the governments in Northern Ireland knew, this was a priority for us. I will say also, you know, there has been an executive where there has been a power sharing arrangement in Northern Ireland. And frankly, that has worked quite well. And that's part of what has helped to bring both economic prosperity and stability to the government there. So I would hope, depending on what happens in the elections this week, both parties continue to talk to each other, because it really has worked quite well for the people of Northern Ireland.
It's very important. I will admit some bias. 7 of my 8 great-grandparents were born in Ireland, and the 8th was born in Scotland to an Irish mother. And so I'm about as Irish as it gets. But the Good Friday Accord is not only important in bringing peace to that region, but we cite it all the time as reason not to be pessimistic about other regions that haven't yet found the path to peace. Mm-hmm. If it can be done in Ireland and Northern Ireland, it can be done. And so there's a lot of reason to make sure that we continue to put our shoulder to forward progress. Ms. Milstein, really good to see you. And I wanted to ask you a question about the topic of the day that's important all around the world, including in Malta. Golden passports, formerly known as citizenship by investment, are programs that grant citizenship to foreign investors who buy expensive real estate or other assets, make sizable investments in countries. Thousands of those passports have gone to Russia's elite in recent years, including many well-known oligarchs, amid concerns that the program enables money laundering and other financial schemes. Malta has been under some pressure from the EU, and they've put its golden passport scheme on hold for Russians and Belarusians, and they're considering ending it altogether. Now, obviously, that's domestic politics for Malta. According to Forbes, more than 40% of the 111 Russian-born billionaires have at least one other passport, and nearly half of the 35 sanctioned billionaires have dual citizenship. How can the U.S. work with Malta to place additional pressure on Russian oligarchs and Putin's allies?
Thank you, Senator Kaine, for that question. It is indeed a problem in Malta, and the Maltese government is aware of the situation. As you mentioned, they have upped their vetting process of applicants, particularly since the situation with Russia has increased in seriousness. The Russians and the I know of two instances where, as you mentioned, the residency of a Russian national as well as a Belarusian national, they were both pulled. And if confirmed, I will work with Malta on rigorously vetting applicants to prevent any loopholes and eroding any kind of sanctions and restrictions.
Thank you for that, Ms. Milstein. And one other thing I'll just say to you is that Malta has been a pretty valuable partner in dealing with refugees. Often refugees coming, you know, through the Mediterranean, you know, have needed to come to Malta for safe haven, and Malta and many NGOs in Malta have been really helpful in dealing with some of these significant humanitarian challenges. And I would hope, if you're confirmed, you'll do what you can from the U.S. Embassy there to be a good ally in those efforts. And knowing you, I don't have any doubt that you will be. So with that, Madam Chair, I yield back.
Well, thank you. And I want to follow up on that a little bit, Ms. Milstein, because obviously one of the challenges is the Russian influence in Malta. And as we look at what's happening in Ukraine, do we have any sense that Russia's invasion of Ukraine has changed how some of the residents of Malta and the officials feel about Russia and potential for Russia to gain influence in the country? And also, how might we use this period to take better advantage of the opportunity to counter that Russian influence in Malta?
Thank you, Senator, for that question. It has indeed been an issue in Malta, and I know of media reports that Malta has, as I said, taken steps to strip Maltese citizenship and residencies from at least the sanctioned Russian nationals. They are further working toward doing what they can as far as the general citizenship by investment program, in terms of being much more particular in terms of their vetting process. And I think this is extraordinarily important.
I certainly agree with that, and think that this is a period where it's very clear who's on the side of good and who's on the side of evil. And for those people around the world who are watching what's happening in Ukraine, this is an opportunity to remind them that most people don't want to be on the side of what Russia is doing in Ukraine. Mr. Leventhal, again, the war in Ukraine has really overshadowed so much of what's going on in the world right now. Can you talk about what Denmark's view is of how the war affects European security? And do you know if Denmark supports expanding participation to Finland and Sweden and NATO?
Senator Shaheen, thank you for the question. Denmark has been a very close ally of the U.S. and a partner in Afghanistan and Iraq, a very strong voice against Russian aggression. It has sent arms to the Baltic, to Estonia that sent troops, to Latvia sending a battalion, F-16s to Lithuania. So it partners with the U.S. and has been a very strong ally. In fact, Denmark has talked about the U.S. being its security partner of choice. Denmark is very supportive, number one, of the open-door policy of NATO, that any country has a sovereign right to put in an application. The Prime Minister of Denmark, Mette Frederiksen, has actually stated that she supports the membership of Finland and Sweden to NATO. I think Denmark is a very important partner in a time of great upheaval and great change and great concern. And if I'm confirmed, I will work to further our security priorities with the Kingdom of Denmark.
Well, thank you. And I was pleased to see Denmark commit to meeting its 2% defense spending requirement for NATO by 2033. That seems like a long time away, especially given the urgency of what's happening right now. Can you comment on whether there's any room to move that deadline up earlier, and what are the barriers that might be prohibiting Denmark from trying to increase its defense spending sooner?
Senator Shaheen, I think it was an important step that Denmark now is committed to meeting its Wales pledge of getting to 2% of GDP. It's true, 2033 sounds a long time from now. They have increased the current budget by $1 billion. Part of that is defense, part of it's humanitarian aid, part diplomacy. If I'm confirmed, I will work with the Danish government to see if that commitment can be accelerated earlier than the 2033 date.
Great, thank you. Senator Marasso.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman. Ms. Milstein, I think it's critically important that people serving our nation as ambassadors demonstrate professionalism and good judgment. So with that in mind, I want to bring up your campaign actions in Wisconsin in the year 2000. You were an adult in your 50s campaigning for the presidential campaign of Al Gore. During the campaign, you were involved in something called Smokes for Votes, and it turned out to be a scandal in Wisconsin. The Milwaukee district attorney at the time explained that it appeared between 15 and 20 homeless men were given tobacco products in exchange for filling out absentee ballots for candidate Al Gore. Media reports noted that you, specifically you, were caught on tape handing out cigarettes to homeless men from the Milwaukee Rescue Mission in exchange for their votes. I mean, as a doctor, I'd point out that smoking causes cancer. Well, the executive director of one of the three shelters, Patrick Vanderberg, was reported as saying that you and six other Gore volunteers approached the homeless men, and they initially did not want to register. Executive director went on to say that they went only after you and the volunteers held up packs of cigarettes to entice them. A Milwaukee Rescue Mission employee told reporters he had to ask Democratic campaign volunteers, you, to leave the property after he caught them trying to bribe potential voters with cigarettes. The campaign for Al Gore distanced themselves from you and your actions. A representative of the Gore campaign in Wisconsin issued this statement about your activities, quote, "This kind of activity described by Channel 12, made the news, is not the kind of help we ask for, and it's the kind of help we flat out reject." In Wisconsin, what you did was illegal, and you ultimately paid a fine of $5,000 for your illegal activities in the campaign. To me, this action raises considerable concerns about your nomination and the vetting process of this administration. So I'd like to give you the opportunity for the committee and others so you can address your involvement with this scandal.
Thank you, Senator, for your question. As you mentioned, this incident happened more than 20 years ago. I don't recall the full details that you are reciting at the present time. I am happy to take your question back for the record and provide you with all the necessary information.
The record is clear. You did pay a $5,000 fine, and be happy to hear and get your written response to that, because I think this calls into question the nomination as well as the vetting process. Ms. Hartley, if I could ask you now. The United Kingdom is an important trade and economic partner to the United States. In 2020, the United Kingdom was the world's fifth largest economy. Bilateral investment between our two countries is the largest in the world. Given the potential for market access and to align regulations, there's a lot of interest in a trade agreement between the United States and the United Kingdom. That would reaffirm our longstanding alliance, build upon our strong economic relationship. So the U.S. and U.K. conducted 5 rounds of negotiations on a bilateral free trade agreement 2 years ago. So could you please outline the potential benefits for the United States in having a free trade agreement with the United Kingdom?
Yes, Senator, thank you for the questions. I agree with you. The U.K. is a critically important trade partner for the U.K., for the U.S. I think between our bilateral trade, it creates about 1 million jobs. We are their biggest source of foreign direct investment, and we are their biggest trading partner. So I couldn't agree more. They also have a market that is particularly a positive for the U.S. Same language, well-trained, educated workforce, the rule of law, strong financial systems. So I agree with you that it is a very important trade partner. And I'm happy to see, as you probably know, there have been quite a few conversations recently in terms of a trade dialogue with Ambassador Tai and their Minister for Trade. I think we've had 2 most recently, and there will be another one in Boston in a couple of weeks, talking about small and medium businesses.
Thank you. I have one last question. That's for Dr. Turner, because our time is limited. There are concerns that Russia might deploy nuclear weapons to neighboring countries. In February, Belarus approved a new constitution, renouncing its non-nuclear status. A U.S. acting permanent representative of the Conference on Disarmament addressed the issue in March. She stated, any movement of Russian nuclear weapons into Belarus would be dangerously provocative and further destabilize the region. We call on Belarus, this is her speaking, to reject Russia's policies of nuclear threat and intimidation. So do you agree with the statement, and is there any indication that you have seen that Russia has moved nuclear weapons into Belarus?
Thank you, Senator, for that question. I have not seen any indication that that is the case. I mean, this is one of the many kinds of threats, reckless threats, escalatory threats that Russia is issuing at this time. Obviously something that, if confirmed, we would want to continue to follow very, very closely and work with our allies and friends to decide how to deal with that kind of an issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Let me congratulate all of you on your nominations. I'm pleased that we're considering nominations for critical posts, including some of our key European allies and partners. Over the past few months, we have been reminded of just how critical the transatlantic alliance and relationship is, and the importance of strengthening partnerships with those who share our commitment to fundamental democratic values. That unity remains paramount as we work to provide Ukraine everything that it needs to counter Russia's brutal and unprovoked war. Every country has a part to play. I just met with a whole slew of parliamentarians from Europe, and we need ambassadors in place to support these efforts, strengthen ties, and maintain that unity. So I personally look forward to advancing your nominations as quickly as possible, assuming I get the right answers. So let me start off with Ambassador Hartley. It's good to see you again. I'm a believer in our special relationship with the United Kingdom, and I'm deeply grateful for the United Kingdom's efforts to support Ukraine and stand up for democracy across the globe. However, the United States also has an important role to play as a guarantor of the Good Friday Agreement, protecting peace on the island of Ireland. I want to ask you, will you commit to using your voice to protect and push for the full implementation of the Good Friday Agreement, including through measures like a Bill of Rights for Northern Ireland, the Irish Language Act, and the establishment of a civic forum?
Yes, Senator, I will. Senator Kane had asked me that question previously,
okay.
And I think this administration and this president has made it very clear that the Good Friday Belfast Agreement has been critically important to Northern Ireland in bringing peace, stability, and economic stability as well, and that we have to make sure that nothing ever happens to jeopardize that. I did also say, because Senator Kane brought up the elections that are happening later this week, that I think the executive and the power-sharing agreement that's been happening in Stormont is also very, very important to progress in Northern Ireland. So I would absolutely make sure both parties are communicating with each other, and I commit to you, yes, that I will.
Thank you. I didn't really want to be redundant. I was not being able to view the hearing while I was with these parliamentarians, but I'm glad to hear your answer. This is the same points I pressed with Prime Minister Boris Johnson when he was here visiting with us not too long ago. Mm-hmm. One other question on Ireland. The British government has reportedly been considering proposals to include a statute of limitations for all prosecutions during the Troubles up to April of 1998, as well as the creation of an information recovery body. I'm a firm believer that there can be no peace in Ireland without justice, and I'm concerned that new bodies floated in the government command paper would be less effective than those that were agreed to in the Stormont House Agreement, which was actually a British document that ultimately got agreed to. So will you commit to standing up for the rights of those in Northern Ireland to seek accountability for trouble, errors, crimes, and to advocate for the full implementation of the Stormont House Agreement?
Yes, I will.
Thank you. Let me turn to, now, Ms. Milstein, I caught the tail end of Senator Barrasso's concerns, and my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, you were a volunteer in the Gore campaign in 2000. That's 22 years ago, by the way. The question was about, in the process of giving rides to voters, whether you offered them some cigarettes. And at the end of the day, the Milwaukee district attorney investigated, found no wrongdoing or evidence that cigarettes were provided in exchange for votes. So if that is the case, I can assure you that we have had nominees here, especially from the previous administration, nominees who were clearly under investigation by the IRS presently, who ultimately got indicted, and members of this committee voted for that individual. So 22 years ago, for something that the Milwaukee district attorney said was no violation of criminal law, is something I don't quite understand being an impediment to moving forward in your nomination, but I look forward to your response to Senator Barrasso in your written response. I do have a concern about money laundering as it relates to Malta. The Financial Action Task Force has assessed that Malta needs to do more to support law enforcement efforts to address money laundering. As we work to expose and rid our systems of malign foreign and oligarchic influence, will you work with Malta to promote greater transparency in its financial systems?
Thank you for that question, Senator Menendez. It would be a great honor for me, and I look forward to working with Malta to try to get them removed from the jurisdictions which are under scrutiny and by FATF.
Right.
This is an international body, as well you know, and the United States has always given more credit than it really has in terms of turning things around. But I'm happy to report to you that the Prime Minister is working to do what he can to get Malta removed from that list as well.
All right. And then Mr. Leventhal, Denmark has announced plans to boost gas output in an effort to become energy self-sufficient and bolster European energy security. How large of a role do you think Denmark can play in helping wean Europe off of Russian fossil fuels? And is there a role for the United States in supporting Denmark's efforts?
As I'm sure you are aware, Senator, Denmark has played a leading role in climate change and leading in moving from a fossil fuel economy. They lead in windmill production across the world, about 25% of production. So I think Denmark has an important role to play.
I hope we will help them. Now, I understand that Senator Booker is actually joining us virtually, so let's call upon him. Senator Booker? Well, now it is the problem of Madam Chair here to figure out. So Booker was supposedly on. Thank you for your answers.
All right, he's got to be here in person. Okay, no one is in line for questions, so I do have a couple more, if you will indulge me. I don't know, Senator Barrasso, if you are finished, but... Dr. Turner, I wanted to ask you a little bit about where we are with our engagement on non-proliferation, because I do think it's very important for the United States to lead in the world. And I wonder if you can talk about the ways in which the United States can substantively re-engage with the Conference on Disarmament and what the implications are for our policy if we aren't able to improve international engagement.
Thank you for that question. It's a very complicated one, I think, in a number of ways. The United States is obviously engaged in these institutions, as in many institutions. Unfortunately, over the past several years, we've gone from an era of cooperation to lots of competition now among great powers and contestation as well of policies that are being put forward. This is a very real challenge. There is very little political will to reach agreement on some of these issues. It is nonetheless important for us to fight the good fight. We are a responsible nuclear power that is pushing to reduce the role of nuclear weapons while maintaining our deterrence relationships and progressing according to the NPT treaty, progressing toward the eventual goal of a world without nuclear weapons by pursuing negotiations in good faith on effective means. And the question is on effective means. And unfortunately, as we all know, Russia is currently violating any number of agreements, has revealed itself to be an irresponsible nuclear power weapon state, unlike the United States, France, and the UK. China has more or less tried to avoid responsibility in this area, preferring to leave everything to the United States and Russia. But we will continue to fulfill our goals. We want to use the review conference to strengthen the NPT regime. We are working hard to persuade China to engage with us bilaterally on risk reduction measures, more transparency, to start acting like the responsible global power that it claims that it is. The Russian problem is a separate issue for the moment. We do have the New START treaty, which we have extended now for another 5 years. We had started the strategic stability dialogue to talk with Russia about things we might do in the future. Our goal, obviously, is to capture all of those theater non-strategic nuclear weapons that Russia is directly or indirectly threatening to use at this very moment. And then with China to get, again, to put in place some mechanisms that will lead to strategic risk reduction. So the NPT review conference in August is going to be very important to that end. We've had some success in the UN First Committee in pushing norms of behavior in space. There's an open-ended working group that will go for a couple of years, and that is also something that we can build on. And finally, at the very end of the year, there will be a review conference for the Biological Weapons Convention, to which we have appointed a special envoy, and the idea there is to break the deadlock, which has gone on now for about 20 years. We do not want to have a full negotiation of a protocol, but we are looking at ways to strengthen the regime, perhaps through the creation of an expert group that would meet for a couple of years and try to come up with some practical measures. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I'm particularly interested in what's happening looking at space, because this is a new frontier, really, in terms of the potential to put weapons in space. And can you talk a little more about the progress that review committee is making?
Excuse me. When it comes to space, recently we had the vice president, who stated that we ourselves would no longer conduct anti-satellite destructive tests in space. So there's that problem. The Russians, as you know, conducted a test in mid-November, which put many thousands of pieces of debris into space and which endangered the space station. So that is the sort of thing that we do not want to do. Over the many, many years, Russia and China have put forward different kinds of treaty proposals that call for no first placement of weapons in outer space. At the very same time that they are now sending satellites into space, which are capable of maneuvering behind other satellites, which have fired projectiles into space, and then they have their direct ascent test. So the fact of the matter is that countries are developing weapons for use in space with the intent of denying the United States use of space, or denying us some use of space over a long period of time. We depend more on space than many of they do for our communications purposes. So this is a very serious issue. The proposal to develop norms of behavior in space is to develop something that would be parallel to what we have in the oceans or commercially in the air, which would, again, it won't solve the problem of what's happening in space, but it will at least make it manageable. It'll make it possible to distinguish commercial satellites from military satellites, and perhaps develop some measures that you keep a certain distance from other satellites in order to avoid putting yourself into a situation where that's perceived as a threat.
Well, thank you very much. I look forward to hearing more about the progress there. Ambassador Hartley, my last question is for you, and I think you have a unique perspective on this, having served as ambassador to France and now looking at the position at the United Kingdom. As you know, we have a new security agreement with Australia, the United Kingdom, and the United States. It's known as AUKUS, and it takes a look at the opportunities for us to have an allied response to the growing threat from China and North Korea in the Indo-Pacific. Can you talk about how important that is and what further opportunities we have to collaborate with AUKUS? Mm-hmm.
I agree, Senator. I think AUKUS is an incredibly important agreement. It deepens our already strong relationship in terms of Five Eyes, particularly with the UK. But it also strengthens, gives us depth and ability to understand more about what's happening in the Indo-Pacific. UK recently, in their last integrated review, said that there was going to be a tilt in their government toward the Indo-Pacific. And we see them spending both more money and they've had various warships there over the last months. I think for us, working with the UK and Australia, will be very important, especially the technology component. And once again, I'm not confirmed, so I don't have a lot of information on this, but the technology component of this deal is going to be very, very important for us.
Thank you. Senator Barrasso, you have no further questions, and I don't think there's anyone else waiting to come, so With that, I'd like to thank all of our nominees today for your testimony and again for your willingness to serve the country. I look forward to working with each of you should you be confirmed. And I know that we are all hoping that these nominations will move forward as expeditiously as possible, because one of the lessons from the war in Ukraine is just how important it is for us to have ambassadors on the ground who can represent American interests. So we do hope to be able to move these as quickly as possible. For the information of all senators, the record of this hearing will remain open until close of business tomorrow, Thursday, May 5th. To my colleagues on the committee, I hope that they will submit any questions during that time, and that to the nominees, if you have any additional questions, I urge you to answer those as fully and expeditiously as possible so that we can move forward with your nominations. With that, the hearing is adjourned, and congratulations to all of you.